We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to take a look at some of the connections between medical malpractice and the cost of health care in the United States. Now, there certainly are some people that argue that doctors' fears about potential lawsuits mean that they do more tests, and that that just adds to the nation's health care bill. And of course, as there are big lawsuits and big awards, some also say, well, that also drives up the cost of insurance for doctors, and that ultimately drives up the cost of health care. At the same time, people do say that doctors do need to be held accountable for their mistakes if they make mistakes, and we do need to make sure that patients are protected. So we have this morning two guests with us on the program to try and talk about this issue a little bit, David Hyman and also Jennifer Robinault, and they're both professors of law here at the University of Illinois. Professor Jennifer Robinault is a professor of both psychology and law, she's interested in her work in bringing psychology into the study of law and legal institutions. David Hyman is very well known for having written about law and health. He's been here before on the program to talk about health-related issues, health reform, and we're pleased that they could both be here and talk with us. Now, of course, as always, people who are listening are welcome to call with their questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, that's the number. We do have a toll-free line, so if it would be long distance, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. We're also taking email questions now. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And that'll really help us, though, if you can keep those brief. And even for people who are calling in, we encourage people to be brief just so we can get as many folks in as possible and keep things moving along. Questions, of course, are welcome. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you, Dave.
The big question I guess I want to start out with, I'm sure it's something we could be talking about for some time, is this question of the relationship between malpractice and costs associated with malpractice and the total cost of health care in the United States. And I suppose if you ask that question, well, in what way does malpractice contribute? The answer kind of depends on who you ask, because there are very strong feelings. You know, lawyers and people who represent them have their feelings. Doctors and people that represent them have their feelings. And Health and Human Services has said one thing, and Congressional Budget Office has said a couple of different things. Do you think that there is a reliable answer to that question? Does malpractice in fact contribute significantly to health care costs?
So let's start by defining a couple of terms because it may be helpful. When people talk about the impact of the medical malpractice system on healthcare spending, what they're also talking about is what people call defensive medicine. That is, things that physicians do in order to lower the probability of their being sued. And those things can take a couple of different forms. People in the field talk about assurance behavior, that is, running additional tests in order to make sure that you've made the right diagnosis, and also what they call avoidance behavior, that is not doing things that are likely to increase your prospect of being sued and being sued successfully. And that can mean things like family physicians no longer delivering babies or avoiding patients that you think are likely to sue. And the key difficulty here is that both avoidance and assurance behavior can have positive benefits for patients, but can also have negative consequences for patients. So running that extra test is a good thing if you should have run that test, if the signal that the malpractice system is sending is saying, be careful and run those additional tests. But if it causes you to run tests just to paper the file to show that you've run a whole bunch of tests and so you sort of looked under every rock for everything that might have been wrong, not all of that is useful behavior, right? Mm-hmm. Some of it's wasteful. Some of it can actually cause additional problems for patients because tests can have side effects and adverse consequences. Similarly, avoidance behavior, some of that could be good for patients if it keeps underqualified people from doing things and channels patients to those best able to treat them. Or it can be really bad if you can't find someone to deliver your baby within 300 miles. That's a real access problem. And so defensive medicine includes different types of behavior, and it has both positive and negative consequences. Now, to answer the more focused question you asked, what's the evidence on the impact of it on healthcare spending? As you point out, the estimates are all over the map. You get very modest numbers from trial lawyers and very large numbers from physicians and physician organizations. People who have less of a direct stake in the outcome have tried to study this. There have been a bunch of studies, and they've come up with, you know, reasonably significant dollar figures. So the Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that defensive medicine that would be reduced by the health reform bill would amount to $55 billion, and that's a lot of money. But there are two things that you need to keep in mind. The first is that the CBO, or Congressional Budget Office, scores things over 10 years. So that's $5.5 billion per year. Mm-hmm. The second thing, and that's still a big number, but the second thing to keep in mind is it's out of a total healthcare spending budget of about $2.5 trillion a year. So it's a big number in isolation, but it's actually a very, very small piece of the total healthcare spending budget. So why do I say that? It's not that we should ignore it. It's that we shouldn't expect addressing defensive medicine is going to make a profound difference in the trajectory of our healthcare spending. Yeah. We shouldn't ignore it, but we shouldn't think it's a panacea.
Well, that's I guess that goes to something that just I was amazed, and I had to go back and forth on this as I was looking at some of what had been written, particularly about the recent sort of change by CBO from having gone to saying, well, it really doesn't contribute much at all, to now talking about what it does contribute, and on the same day. This was on October 10th last year. In the Boston Globe, the headline was, "Medical Malpractice Overhaul Could Save Billions." Same day, LA Times, "Malpractice Reform Savings Likely Small." And, but then when when I went back and looked at it, they were doing exactly what – they were doing it like you were talking about. They were saying, on the one hand, as a total piece of change, well, yeah, if we're talking about $50 billion to anybody, that's a lot of money. But – as a percentage of how much we spend, we're spending so much that that's actually pretty small. So I guess it kind of depends on how it is you want to look at it as a total pot of money, which is a lot, but it's pretty small compared to how much we spend.
Yeah, the other thing to recognize is that even if it's a pretty sizable number for defensive medicine, and I think, you know, it's probably a pretty respectable number. Coming up with ways of actually reducing it turns out to be very difficult, okay? The sort of most typical strategy people have talked about are caps on non-economic damages. Yeah. Very popular reform, about 30 states have a cap on either total damages or non-economic damages, and we can talk a little bit about what the differences are if you like. But it turns out that's just not a particularly effective way of targeting defensive medicine, because all it's doing is saying to physicians, if something goes wrong and you get sued and you're ultimately held liable, the maximum non-economic damages that will have to be paid by you or on your behalf will only be up to whatever the cap is. In Illinois right now, it's $500,000. Okay, so it's a very sort of downstream kind of reform. It's not really an aggressive attempt to address defensive medicine.
Yeah. Here, there are a number of things I think we can come back to, but I want to turn here to Professor Robinall. And I guess one of the things that I'm interested in talking about is if what we're really concerned about is people who have been harmed, What's the best way to try to make them whole to the extent that you can? And so we want to hold physicians accountable for mistakes, particularly if they're mistakes that have to do with incompetence and bad judgment. And we say, well, people should be compensated. Is the way that we're doing it now, is that the best way? Or maybe is there a better way to try to accomplish those goals?
So the traditional way of responding to a patient who's been injured as a result of a medical error is sort of deny and defend. We didn't do anything wrong, and we're going to defend it to the end, right? And what I've looked at and others have looked at is sort of thinking about what people who are injured by medical errors want, what causes them to bring lawsuits, what kinds of things would it take to make them whole. And, of course, many of them have financial issues that need to be addressed. They've got bills or they're out of work and so on. But a lot of studies have found that in addition to those financial issues, patients want a set of things that are interrelated and not so financial. So they want an explanation about what has happened to them. They want to know how this error happened and what the consequences are for their health. They want accountability. They want to know sort of how it happened. And they want some reassurance that it's not going to happen again to them or to someone else in the future. And those are related. And they're all tied to communication with the physician or other healthcare provider following the error. There are studies that show that lawsuits are more likely when the communication is poor. And so one thing that a number of hospitals have attempted in recent years is to sort of move away from the deny and defend kind of model to a model that discloses errors to patients and apologizes. And an apology can address those concerns that patients have because it's a conversation in which an explanation can be provided, accountability can be assessed, brainstorming about what to do to prevent the same kind of error from recurring can happen. Mm-hmm. And so both experiences in some of those hospitals that have tried it and other kinds of studies have shown that an apology from a healthcare provider to an injured patient can reduce the need of the patient to file a lawsuit. And even when there is a lawsuit, it may make sort of addressing the financial issues easier because there's less anger and less need to get explanations. Mm.
And I think that I want to make sure that people understand we're not talking about apology in lieu of compensation.
Right.
We're talking about apology in addition to compensation.
Exactly.
But what's happening here is that there seems to be good evidence to show that people who have been injured that, they're interested in fair compensation, but they also want these other things as well. And if you can find a way to provide them that there is the tendency to go to the point of filing suit is less, I think that they come through the process at least feeling a little bit better about it, about the whole thing, about the outcome. And is it also the case that overall the costs, say like the costs to the institution and to whatever whoever pocket it's coming out of, that those costs are actually less?
Yes. The experience of the places that have tried it tends to be that they pay out a higher number of claims, in part because they're disclosing errors to patients who may not otherwise have realized that there had been an error, but that the total dollar cost of those payouts are lower. Suggesting that each particular payout may be lower than it would have been had it gone through the traditional litigation system. And also that the costs of litigating themselves, the attorney's fees and so on, are lower because things can get resolved more quickly, perhaps without the same kinds of extensive discovery prior to trial. So things seem to get resolved more quickly and for lower total dollar payouts. Hmm.
So how common is this kind of approach now?
There are, I would say, a handful of hospitals, academic medical centers, the ones that get most of the attention. There's a VA hospital in Lexington, Kentucky that has done this for a number of years, the University of Illinois Medical Center, the University of Michigan Medical Center have all sort of taken a comprehensive approach to this kind of responding to error, as well as a number of individual physicians and healthcare providers that have sort of tried this. So it's I would say it's new and growing, and is starting to spread beyond sort of the initial places where it's been tried.
Yeah, some insurance companies are also experimenting with this as well, with the hope that it will basically resolve cases faster and at a lower cost. And following up on one of the things that Professor Robinault said, it's important to recognize, first of all, that lots of people who are injured never find their way to a lawyer, never bring suit. And so if you're going to seek those people out and disclose to them that there was an error, your claim, your number of claims is going to go up, okay? At the same time, you need to recognize that lots of people who were unhappy with their healthcare provider but not negligently injured in the current system walk to the door of an attorney and try and initiate a lawsuit. And there are very good studies that show plaintiffs' lawyers turn away an overwhelming majority of the people who walk through their doors who are unhappy with their healthcare providers, typically because the damages aren't large enough or the liability isn't clear enough. And so I want to second what Professor Robinault said. Communication strategies between physicians and patients are a very important predictor of whether people initiate a lawsuit or not and find their way to a lawyer even if they can't initiate a lawsuit.
Yeah. Well, again, I guess this gets me back to this question asking this question, the way that we're doing it now, does that really benefit patients who have been injured? And it sounds as if really in spite of some of the kind of things that you read, you have to say that, first of all, most of the people who are injured never even get to the point of filing a lawsuit. Of those people who think about it, they maybe go to the lawyer and the lawyer says, no, I just don't think so. And then of the people who actually do file a lawsuit, the percentage of those that actually win is small. It can take a long time for them to see the benefit even if they do win. Legal costs can eat into that. So when you add all of those things up, it seems that probably the system that we have now is it really doesn't work as well as maybe it should or could, maybe even as well as people actually think that it does.
There are huge problems with the current system. It's slow, it's expensive, it's very unpleasant for both negligently injured patients and for physicians who find themselves having claims filed against them, and it casts a shadow over their lives. I talk with medical students and I say to them, look, you know, after divorce and the death of a child, getting sued for malpractice is probably one of the worst things that can happen to you in your life. Mm-hmm. It'll cause you to doubt your professional competence. And that'll be what you think about. There are lots of instances of physicians retiring after they've been sued, even if they've ultimately been exonerated. So that, you know, there are lots of problems with the current system. The other thing to recognize is we shouldn't just focus on whether the system works for people who've been injured. We also need to ask, are we as a society getting out of the malpractice system what we wanted, which was to create incentives for care, that is being careful in delivering healthcare services and avoiding negligence, that is to say deterring negligent treatment. And I think there's, you know, quite good evidence that we're not getting very good value out of it from that perspective either. And that's why you see periodic proposals for a variety of reforms. Apology is a useful way, I think, of improving the current system, but there are also proposals to scrap it entirely and move to some other strategy for ensuring the delivery of consistent, high-quality care.
Our guests this morning in this hour of Focus 580, David Hyman and Jennifer Robinault. They're both professors of law here at the University of Illinois. In addition, Professor Robinault is also professor of psychology. And we're talking here about medical malpractice and how that fits into the whole debate about healthcare reform in this country. Questions are welcome, and in fact, we have a couple here ready to go. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have several here ready to go. And again, people will help us if they can keep their comments brief, but we want to get in as many as possible. Starting with Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to, in my practice as a lawyer, I would say I would agree with your observations about a patient is much less likely to sue if a doctor admits that they made a mistake. And Also that lawyers are very reluctant to take malpractice cases because of the cost and also because doctors set their own standard of care. And the mistake has to be really bad in order to persuade a jury that malpractice has happened. My question would be, if there was another system that was more like an arbitration-based system, if the standard of care might be set in a different way so that more patients would be compensated. And I'll just listen to what you have to say about the standard of care and how it's set and if that might change with a different system. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call.
Yeah, there have been periodic proposals to handle malpractice by contract as opposed to what lawyers call tort. Okay, under the tort system, professional custom dictates what the standard of care is. So what other doctors say the right thing to be done is what decides whether or not you breach that standard of care. The other nature of the tort system is all of the cases go through a sort of civil justice. You file a lawsuit. The insurance company gets involved. At the end of the road, if the parties can't settle, there's going to be a jury trial. And there have been a whole bunch of proposals to modify those approaches by contract. So you can contract out of the legal system, whether into a health court where healthcare providers would be involved in deciding whether or not the standard of care was met rather than a jury. You could do mediation. You could think about arbitration. You could see waivers of liability entirely, right? If somebody treated you for free, you might waive your liability rights against them. And there have been lots of proposals to do things like that, and they've pretty much gone absolutely nowhere. And the reason is a broader point about the politics of malpractice reform at the state level, which is it's basically a big fight between the plaintiff's bar and the physicians. And the question is, at any given point in time, which one is more powerful? And CAHPS have ended up being the battleground that we've been fighting over since the mid-1970s on a state-by-state basis. There have been some other types of reforms that have been tried. I don't want to suggest that's the only thing. So there have been screening panels that a bunch of the states have tried where before you can file the lawsuit, you need to go before a panel made up of often a physician, a lawyer, and a retired judge. And then the idea was that that would help get rid of the bad cases, bad in the sense of they shouldn't be moving forward. And it was expected that that would speed up the resolution of cases and lower the costs. It actually pretty much had the opposite impact, unfortunately, because everybody treats the screening panel as a dress rehearsal for the full-blown trial. The last point I just want to flag because it's often overlooked is people talk a lot about juries and jury incompetence, and that's a fair observation, but you should recognize the overwhelming majority of cases, something like 97% of the cases where there's a payout are the result of a settlement between the two sides where the insurance company just cuts a check. Case never goes in front of a jury. Mm-hmm.
I would add that sort of that negotiation process that's handling 97% of the cases or some variant like mediation where there's a neutral third party who comes in to assist that negotiation, one of the potential benefits is allowing the two sides to come up with their own sort of standards for how they're going to resolve the case. At the same time, though, the alternative, if that doesn't work out, is litigation, right? So that's always in the background, even of these more informal processes.
Yeah, and just following on that, it's not just that there are differences in how they're handled. You also see differences in the reforms or the responses that happen at the back end, the remedies that are available is probably the right word. So what can the legal system do? It can basically make the defendant write a check to the plaintiff. But that's often not the only thing or even the most important thing that the plaintiff wants. The plaintiff is interested in an explanation and the plaintiff wants some assurance that it won't happen to anybody else, as Professor Rabinowitz said previously. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the appeal of these alternative informal strategies is that the two parties can sort of come up with a mutually beneficial strategy that prevents future repetition.
Right, let's talk again with another caller. The next in line would be in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I think you've touched on what I had in mind and maybe you have kind of a negative view of it. I was going to ask about some other states that have commissions or committees or whatever they might call them that do, and if I'm using the wrong word, a lot of people can correct it, to some extent vet any case that actually makes it to trial. And I know in Indiana that's met with satisfaction on both sides to a pretty good extent. And it just seems, you know, we need to try a fresh look. And I would say I was just going to add Johns Hopkins to the list of medical centers that are taking a different approach that you talked about earlier and saying, we're sorry, we want to help make things better for you. And I'd just like to hear your comment about this. And I hope maybe negotiation could be a little more successful than I feel you have suggested that it has been up to now. Thank you.
Okay.
So these kinds of conversations that patients and healthcare providers can have, we've talked mostly about the benefits for the patients and about the costs, but they can also be really beneficial to the healthcare providers themselves. So physicians, when they're surveyed, say that they when they make a mistake, they actually would like to apologize, and that you know they're told they ought to not communicate and not apologize. And so I think one of the benefits of sort of negotiations and conversations between injured patients and physicians is also for the physician. They talk about sort of when they realize they've made a mistake, sort of that feeling in the pit of their stomach and the benefits of talking about it with the patient and offering an apology to the patient can be significant for physicians as well.
Well, again, I would encourage people who are listening to call with questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me again introduce our guests, both on the faculty of the University of Illinois College of Law. Jennifer Robinolt is a nationally known scholar in the area of psychology and law, as well as torts, and I guess that's what we usually call personal injury law. For those of us who are not lawyers, also she's interested in dispute resolution. And David Hyman, he among his interests are regulation of healthcare financing, medical malpractice, and managed care. And here we're talking about malpractice, the system that we have, and asking some questions about, well, is there a better way to do it? Questions here, welcome. Something that I wanted to have David Hyman talk about is some work that you have done looking at the costs of malpractice, because I think that, first of all, people have this idea that we have lots and lots of lawsuits, injury lawsuits. People have been injured. Juries find in their favor, and then big damages are awarded. And then the result of that is for doctors, they have to pay much higher premiums on their malpractice insurance. Now, you've actually taken a look at this. You looked at cases in the, I think it was in the state of Texas, like from the late 80s to the early 2000s, and you found some interesting things that I think goes counter to what I think we think is going on. And talk about that.
So, with some co-authors, we've written now it's probably close to a dozen papers using this closed claims database from Texas. And the reason we did Texas is it's one of the only states that had a publicly accessible database of all of the claims that had closed with payment across five lines of insurance, although we focused on medical malpractice for an extended period of time. A number of states have since started databases like this. Florida has had one for about a similar amount of time. Illinois, interestingly, has such a database, but the data is not publicly available, so we couldn't use it to do research. The database starts in 88 and right now, it actually runs through about 2007, and we're continue to do research on it. But I think the paper we did, that you're highlighting either ran through 2003 or 2005. I've forgotten because different papers have different end dates. Yeah. This is the problem with having multiple papers on a subject. So anyway, what we did is we looked at a very simple question. Do defendants pay what juries award? Okay. And remember what I'd said previously, that the overwhelming majority of cases are resolved through voluntary settlement. So this is a very, very small piece of the pie, but it obviously has implications for how the rest of the cases end up being handled, because people settle in the shadow of what they expect to happen if the case goes to trial. And what we discovered was really very striking. That is, juries awarded an amount, which I think it was close to $500 million that in 1988 dollars, so basically double it to get to the current value. When you have cases from different years, you need to adjust for inflation in order to compare the cases one to another. And what we discovered was that less than half of that amount was ultimately paid. Less than half. Okay, about 46% of the total was actually paid. And we found a very predictable pattern, which is the bigger the verdict, the more likely and larger the disparity between the amount the jury had awarded and what we called the haircut, amount.
So the bigger awards, the words, the less.
The less is a percentage they ended up getting. They got more absolute dollars. But in terms of a percentage of the award, so I should pull out the numbers to give you a sort of exact figure. But if the jury awarded you $100,000, you got about 96% of it. If the jury awarded you $1 million, you got about 70% of it. If the jury awarded you $10 million, you got maybe 30% of it.
Oh,
okay. Mm-hmm. So a very sizable disparity. And then we went and looked at, well, what caused that, right? Why were the plaintiffs willing to accept less than the jury had said they were entitled to? And it turns out there are three possible explanations. One is, you know, the judge basically chops down the award or the appellate court reverses. Two is there's a statutory cap. That is to say, the state of Texas caps non-economic damages as well as some other types of damages. And third is the parties just voluntarily settle for reasons that I'll talk about in a minute. It turns out judicial oversight is really not particularly significant. Caps are responsible for about 30% of the dollar spread. The overwhelming majority, something like 67% of the disparity between the amount that was awarded and the amount that was paid was because of the impact of the policy limits. Okay? Defendants and physicians in our data set simply weren't making out-of-pocket payments. If the jury awarded more than the policy limits, the plaintiff just took the policy limits and walked away. So if the doctor had $500,000 in insurance coverage, it didn't matter whether the jury awarded $500,000, $5 million, or $50 million. The plaintiff was going to get the same $500,000.
So and one other thing now here that you looked at and I think is also very interesting, and that has to do with the relationship between the premiums that doctors have to pay and awards that are being paid out. Because again, I think the idea is that, well, these lawsuits and the amounts of damages that are being awarded have gone up. So as a result, the premiums have been increased, and then that leads to a problem that you kind of talked about earlier, where either doctors say, well, you know, I'm not going to do a certain kind of procedure and certain going to do certain kind of things, or maybe you have cases where doctors move to other states because it's better for them to be, you know, practicing elsewhere. And it sounds as if, based on what you've looked at, is that the whatever is going on that's leading to insurance companies to increase the rates, it is not the result of damage awards.
So just let me flag, there's two separate issues that you want to keep separate, right? Okay. One is if an individual physician is sued, and leaving aside whether the case is successful or not, what happens to their malpractice premium? Okay, so stated differently, is it like auto insurance?
Right. If you have an accident.
If you get an accident or a couple of tickets, right. Do your rates go up? That's a separate question from why did malpractice premiums go up for everybody starting in sort of late 99, early 2000? What was the cause of that premium spike? And that was, by the way, not the only such premium spike, right? We had one in the mid-1980s and we had one in the mid-1970s. Okay, so let me focus on that issue first. Mm-hmm. What caused it? Well, you can think about two possible explanations. One is something was going on in the civil litigation system. There were more claims, or there were more dollars per claim, or it suddenly cost a lot more in defense costs to resolve those cases. Those are the sort of three possible explanations on the litigation side. Or something was going on the insurance side of the equation. Did the cost of reinsurance go up? Did insurers suddenly conclude that they weren't – their projections about how much they would make as investment income, did they conclude those were off and they needed to basically change those projections, which would mean they'd have to increase their premiums and make more money through underwriting income rather than investment income? Now, we looked pretty carefully at the first set of possible explanations because that's what we had the data for. And we really didn't see any significant changes in the number of claims or the dollars per claim. We did see some increase in the defense costs, but not a big enough increase to explain the big premium spikes that we were seeing. It's important to control for population and for inflation when you're doing these sorts of comparisons across years, right? Because mm-hmm. if more people move into Texas, you'd expect more claims simply because there are more people in Texas. That's not a real increase in the claiming rate. That's just an increase in the number of people that are receiving medical treatment. So after you control for those things, basically the trends for number of claims and dollars per claim were effectively flat or even declining. So it didn't look like the premium spikes that hit Texas. You know, your mileage may vary is what I say when I give this talk. But it's hard to see that the premium spikes that hit Texas were attributable to anything dramatic going on in the litigation system. And again, to reiterate, that's not a defense of the current system. That mm-hmm. doesn't mean the current system is operating all that well. We talked at the top of the hour about all of the problems. But if it's not the litigation system, you need to think separately about the kinds of strategies you want to use to reform the system if what you're trying to do is to prevent such spikes in the future.
Yeah. We are at our point here. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this hour of focus. We have another caller. And again, let me just very quickly introduce our guests, David Hyman and Jennifer Robinault. They're both professors of law here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the malpractice system that we have in this country and its relationship with healthcare costs. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks. It's a very interesting topic. And I had to step away from the radio for a few minutes, so I hope you didn't address these questions already. But I wondered about what the research on international comparisons might show. I mean, you know, how different systems in different countries operate, and presumably, you know, since the U.S. is about the highest healthcare anywhere in the world or the industrialized world, how that relates and with malpractice and everything in terms of international relationships. And I also wonder if, you know, you have thoughts about how the reforms that are likely, I guess, or maybe not, or somewhat likely to be enacted in the next few weeks or months, how those will affect this whole system. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen to what you say over the air.
All right. Thank you. Both really good questions. Can one of your both of you say something about how in other countries do they deal with the same issue?
So different countries have different strategies because they have different healthcare financing and delivery systems. Many of the countries have a sort of no-fault system where you don't have to prove negligence. And in fact, in those systems, physicians often assist patients in filing for compensation. Mm. Not all of them, obviously. And they are often sort of government-run, centralized systems. They, in some ways it's similar, I suppose you might say, to our workers' comp system. And with both the pluses and minuses that are associated with that. The key questions to ask yourself are about any system, ours and others, is, well, how good a job does it do in compensating injured patients, and how good a job does it do in sending a signal back to the healthcare delivery system? You didn't get that one quite right. You might want to change the way you're doing things, okay? And I think our system doesn't do a particularly good job of that. Other systems, it varies how good a job they do. You can run them with a lower overhead. That's, I think, an important feature, right? Mm-hmm. Any system where you don't have to demonstrate fault is going to be cheaper to run. But again, going back to what I said at the outset, I don't think there's much of a connection between your choice of your liability system and your healthcare spending patterns, okay? If we scrapped the liability system tomorrow, just prohibited people from filing lawsuits, really much regardless of what we put in its place, I don't think there'd be a profound effect on our healthcare spending. It would have an effect, but it wouldn't, you know, be profound. Second, on the question of reforms, a lot depends on what comes out of the conference committee, although it's not clear there's going to be a committee based on the press that I'm seeing. There's a provision in the House bill that basically sends some money to the states if they try and do some health reform with regard to malpractice. And they list several possibilities. One is what's called an early offer program. And I've forgotten what the second one is. I think it's actually an apology system. But there's nothing similar in the Senate bill. And the politics of this are that the plaintiff's lawyers, who are an important factor in Democratic politics, don't want any reforms to the system. And so a lot's going to depend on how that ends up playing out.
Well, I'm glad the question came up, because I don't recall having – I know the president himself back last summer was saying that he thinks that this is something that needs attention and would like to see it as part of the whole – as part of the whole process. But I guess as things were going along, I don't recall having heard much discussion about this at all.
No, I haven't heard much discussion either. I do want to add one thing to the international question, though, and that the one thing that I found interesting in looking at studies that compare disclosure rates across different countries with different litigation systems is, even though physicians in different systems perceive different risks of being sued in those different systems, their disclosure practices are similar. So again, sort of suggesting that the link between the litigation and the litigation outcomes and practices isn't as tight as we all think it is, that even when the risk of being sued is relatively low, there are other things that prevent healthcare providers from disclosing to patients.
Yeah, just to follow on that, that's exactly right. So in the Veterans Administration, you basically can't sue individual physicians because of the way that the legislation is set up, the Federal Tort Claims Act, and the system is liable for any of the mistakes that are made. And there's, you know, so there's no individualized liability risk. If you were looking for a place where you would have free-flowing exchange of information, that would be it. And there just isn't any evidence that they're much better than the rest of the healthcare system.
We have some other callers here. We'll try to get in as many as we can. And next in line, Champaign County, and line two. Hello.
Well, I wanted to ask more about the international dimension. That was really my question. And I specifically wanted to ask about Canada, because they, despite all the publicity here about the healthcare system, they have an overwhelming of approval of their system. I think it was up in the 80 percentile, and that must include the malpractice problem, which I guess is handled as a no fault. So I think that that is really the direction to go. The other more general point about malpractice, even though there's only a moment I'll make it, which is when you hear these statistics about the litigiousness of this country, it's true, but the image we have of a person suing a corporation, most of the litigiousness is actually intra-corporate. And if you take those figures away, we're not exceptionally litigious. And as you say, a lot of people just abandon all hope and give up because the system is so stacked against us. And this should be part of the healthcare debate, it seems to me. And It doesn't seem to be, but the Canadians seem to have a better idea, and it probably includes the negligent or accidental bad practice, I'll call it, instead of malpractice. Thank you.
All right. Do you know anything specifically about Canada? No.
Not enough to comment. I mean, on the issue of does popular perceptions of a healthcare system tell you anything useful about the performance of the system, I think the answer is a lot less than we might like. If you look across countries, what you see is with very different healthcare systems, nobody's all that happy with their system. Everybody thinks there's got to be a magic bullet somewhere else. So the Commonwealth Fund actually did, I think, a pretty nice study across a half a dozen. You know, these are not third world countries. These are first world countries. And they found basically very high degree of dissatisfaction with the performance of every healthcare system. Everybody's facing the same challenges. And if I can, I actually just tracked down what the president said about defensive medicine on September of 2009. It was sort of a beautifully crafted statement. You can tell he used to be a law professor. It says, quote, "I don't believe malpractice reform is a silver bullet, but I have talked to enough doctors to know that defensive medicine may be contributing to unnecessary costs." So it's about as hedged as you can come up with. I think if there had been a clear signal that you needed to include comprehensive malpractice reform in the reform bills, we would have seen something much more impressive than we in fact do currently.
All right. To another caller here. Next, Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. I've been in the insurance business for 30 years, and tort reform, specifically in Illinois, has really crippled the state either to do business. We're one of the states that are on the very bottom to do business because of our lawsuits that are filed. The doctors have to threaten to leave the state for anything to change. And the sad thing is the legislators, all attorneys, and they have practices on the side, and they're not going to change a lot of legislation that feeds them. And the state in itself is in such disarray because they don't want to change any of the laws. And so if you take the corporations that we've seen in the last 2 years of these CEOs getting these big bonuses and getting subsidized by the federal government, and then limiting of what their payouts can be, I think the same thing should be done with these lawyers that are making the laws to tilt the tables towards themselves. And I've talked to legislators in Springfield specifically. Take Madison County, for example. In Illinois, large settlements are all taken to Madison County, and they're settled down there. Because it is a haven for big settlements, and this is the natural the way we do business in this country is the lawyers make all the laws to line their pockets in legislation. And so I'm just being in the insurance business, I see how this thing works. And settlements might not be as large as they are, but they sure get their legal fees paid outside the settlement, because legal fees are one thing, and a settlement is another. And an insurance policy, there is an unlimited legal fee limit. So you can have an actual settlement of $100,000, but technically you can have $1 million of legal fees. And what they see is the $100,000 of judgment paid and not the legal fees that are tied to it of $1 million. That's really how the insurance really works. And I'll hang up.
All right. Well, you want to comment on that?
So we're here to talk about medical malpractice, and I think there have been some studies of medical malpractice claiming at an individual county level, in fact, looking at Madison and St. Clair County and indicating that at least for medical malpractice cases, there isn't much evidence that there's anything special going on in Madison or St. Clair County. Cook County actually is often highlighted as a problem where their jury verdicts are higher than the surrounding areas as opposed to Madison. There is some evidence indicating that there have been issues with class action settlements in Madison and St. Clair County, and that's a separate question. You need to look at that separately. You know, this is the sort of forum shopping, as it's called, where people try and find a jurisdiction that looks favorable to them. And the American Tort Reform Association has, you know, done a fair amount of work with, I think, the Chamber of Commerce, trying to identify what they call tort hellholes. And Madison and St. Clair County are sort of perpetually on that list. But at least on the medical malpractice side, which is what we were talking about today, there just isn't much evidence that that's the problem.
Well, we're coming here to the point where we have about a minute or so left. I guess I'm just interested in the question, if things do change, what's likely to make them change? And it sounds to me that perhaps if more institutions get more experience with the kind of system that we talked a little bit about earlier, that is a different kind of approach, that if anything's going to change, it might be likely to be that as more and more people do that, they kind of see how other people are doing it, they see how it works, maybe they try it, that seems to be maybe more likely than anything else to change the way we approach this. Do you think so?
I think that's possible. And it's interesting to note in that regard that may not be a legal change. That may be more of a cultural change. Mm-hmm. There are things we could potentially do in terms of legal reform that might sort of incentivize those kinds of systems. But at root, it's a different way of thinking about how we approach resolving these kinds of disputes. Mm.
And that's really the strength of voluntary contracts, right, is people can adopt these things and you don't have to have a one-size-fits-all, I-know-the-right-answer solution. That's part of the weakness of trying to do this through legislation, is if you don't know what the answer is at the front end, it's hard to dictate it.
Yeah. Well, at that, we'll have to leave it with the thanks to our guests. They're both members of the faculty of the University of Illinois College of Law, David Hyman, who's very much interested in the issue of medical malpractice and also healthcare financing, and Jennifer Robinault, who is in her interests include psychology and law, dispute resolution, and torts. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.